Good afternoon. Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Speaking in Maine brings you public policy lectures, debates, and panel discussions from across Maine. Speaking in Maine takes us today to Northport and the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations as they welcome award-winning author and journalist Colin Woodard. He is currently state and national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald, Maine Sunday Telegram, where he was a 2016 Pulitzer Prize finalist and received a 2012 George Polk Award for investigative reporting. Introducing Colin Woodard today is Mac DeFord.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the January meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you from the Midcoast of Maine. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum, which was founded in 1983, that's 34 years ago, by a small group of area residents with a special interest in U.S. foreign policy and our role in international affairs. We meet on a monthly basis to hear retired foreign policy officials, academics, journalists, and international businessmen discuss important foreign policy issues. Our membership, which is currently about 240, includes not just those who are interested in foreign affairs, but as well many who have lived and worked abroad and have considerable expertise about many of the issues discussed. For additional information, please visit our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we are really lucky to have a Mainer talking to us. Colin Woodard, an award-winning author and journalist, currently with the Portland Press Herald, where he was a 2016 Pulitzer Prize finalist. He received a 2012 George Polk Award for his investigative reporting. He's also a contributing editor at Politico, writes for the Washington Monthly, and does book reviews for the Washington Post. During his career, he's reported for more than 50 foreign countries and lived for more than 4 years in Eastern Europe. He's the author of American Nations, a history of the 11 rival regional cultures of North America, which was named one of the best books of 2011 by the editors of The New Republic and The Globalist. His 2004 bestseller was The Lobster Coast, Rebels, Rusticators, and the Struggle for a Forgotten Frontier, a particularly popular book up here. His newest book, American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good, was published last year by Viking. And American Character is the title of his talk today. So a particularly warm welcome to a fellow Mainer, Colin Woodard.
Thank you, and thank you to the forum for having me. As mentioned, I'm going to be talking about a little bit about how I came to write American Character, a bit about what the book aims to accomplish, and a bit about its premises and conclusions. We can speak in the Q&A about some of the foreign policy implications of it. I'm a foreign correspondent myself and student of international relations, so pleased to be speaking to an audience also interested in these things. Out of curiosity, how many people here have read American Nations? Yeah, good majority. Excellent, excellent. Well, this book takes up basically where American Nations left us. And the central argument, as you may recall, in American Nations is that you can't understand American history or our identity or indeed even our current political cleavages, which are geographic even as they're ideological, without knowing that there's never been just one America, but rather several Americas. That we're not a nation state, we're a federation of several stateless nations. Regional cultures that have always had their own characteristics, most of them tied back to the differences between the Euro-American colonies that took shape on the eastern and southwestern rims of what are now the United States in the 17th and early 18th century. The original clusters of American colonies were settled by people from distinct regions of the British Isles, and from France and the Netherlands and from Spain, each with their own religious, political, and ethnographic values and characteristics. For generations, these discrete Euro-American cultures developed in remarkable isolation from one another, consolidating their own cherished principles and fundamental values and expanding across the eastern half of the continent in nearly exclusive settlement bands. Now, some of these regional cultures, these nations, championed individualism. Others, utopian social reform. Some believe themselves guided by divine purpose. Others champion freedom of conscience and inquiry. Some embraced an explicit Anglo-Protestant identity. I'm looking at you, greater New Englanders. others ethnic and religious pluralism. Some valued equality and democratic participation in politics, others deference to a traditional aristocratic social order modeled on the slave states of classical antiquity. They laid down the cultural DNA. Oh, here's the Southwest, by the way, the area that Spain settled. Many people are, of course, aware that Spain claimed much of the western half of what's now the United States, but the areas that they actually colonized successfully and actually settled are the ones that you in the room would have seen in the map and are a small subset of those for those in the radio audience. So they ended up laying down the cultural DNA of the different regions they colonized, the institutions and values and unspoken assumptions and symbols and narratives of who we are as a people, the legal and social framework. In short, all the aspects of what anthropologists think of as culture were laid down by these early settlement waves as a sort of fait accompli for everyone else who came along. And there are now 11 of these regional cultures today. These are them, those of you in the audience, these are them in a county-level resolution. For those listening on the radio, the borders between these regional cultures as they spread out do not correspond to state boundaries. Now, how did they do this? Well, let me talk about what the idea is by describing the spread of a couple of these regional cultures. What you see up there, those of you in the room, is Yankeedom. For those in the radio audience, a tier including New England, upstate New York, part of Ohio hugging the lakes, and much of the upper Great Lakes states are all an area of sort of greater New England cultural space. What I mean by that is this culture was originally settled, of course, as an outgrowth of the Puritan migration. The Winthrop fleet came, coming to set a light on the hill, create a applied Calvinist utopia, a more perfect society on earth, which would be done through public institutions, where individuals needed to stand down to the common good purpose of the culture's mission. They annexed the old colony of the Pilgrims at Plymouth and the strange wayward royalist settlements along the coast of Maine under Sir Ferdinando Gorges. And then, after the Dutch were defeated in New Amsterdam and New Netherland in the 1660s, there was a huge wave of settlement that poured over into the new colony of New York. And it was done in a particular way because, for those of you who remember in your high school and junior high school U.S. history textbooks, it'd be the maps of the United States, right, in the early days of the colonies. And often, each of the colonies, most of them would have the colony, the shape you kind of recognize of Virginia or Massachusetts, but it also have this strip about as wide as the colony going all the way out to the Pacific Ocean, because in theory, they claimed everything west of them between their borders all the way out to, they hadn't found the Pacific Ocean, but whatever's out there, we claim all of it, right? And the problem was when the Dutch were defeated, Massachusetts, the Commonwealth, had such a claim over a Massachusettsian-wide strip of New York State running all the way out there. So when the Dutch were defeated and this royalist colony of New York was to be set up, there was this dispute. And the compromise that came out of the dispute was that, yes, the king's brother, the Duke of York, will in fact have sovereignty over this territory, but by way of compensation, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts will have deed rights, title, to all of that land. And the Commonwealth, as a government, then assigned to anointed Massachusetts land companies to colonize that strip, which was done usually by Calvinist ministers leading an entire portion of their flock, entire family units from one community to go deploy a new settlement in the wilderness as part of the New England mission to save the West from the Kentuckians or whatnot, and to further the Yankee way, which is why that whole strip of upstate New York has so many communities which resemble so much New England ones, all the way down to their meeting halls and their town greens at the center. Fast forward another generation when the Northwest Territory and later the Ohio Territory are being formed, and you ran into the same issue, because guess what? Connecticut had a Connecticut-wide strip, in theory, all the way to the Pacific. And that portion of Ohio, dark blue for those of you in the audience, hugging Lake Erie, is the Western Reserve of Ohio. The Western Reserve of Connecticut is what it was called. That's the part that the Connecticut government claimed. And there was the similar compromise of the federal government. Connecticut received land title to that area, and it was settled by Connecticut-based land companies also deploying their New England-style settlements in the Western Reserve of Ohio and only the Western Reserve, because other parts of Ohio had entirely different settlement histories, including an area reserved for Virginia veterans. So that portion of Ohio, the Western Reserve, has very different characteristics than others. You go on another generation to the Michigan Territory being opened up, and the first wave of settlers, the founders of the lumber communities, the first territorial governors and state governors, and those who came together to write Michigan's state constitution were almost all New Englanders from the upstate of Yankee-settled upstate of New York or from the Western Reserve of Ohio, ditto for Minnesota and those portions of Wisconsin, you see. So they laid down the cultural assumptions over that region. Contrast that with another region. You could tell a story like this for most of the regional cultures on the map, but contrast it, for instance, in the greater Appalachian zone. In that area, which would have started in south-central Pennsylvania, you had a very different group of people coming in the 1730s who founded that culture. They were coming from the war-torn borderlands of Britain, from Ulster, from lowlands of Scotland, from the English marches, from areas where there was very little effective government on the ground, where there was constant warfare and upheaval, and where you had to protect your kith and kin yourself. Investing long-term in social institutions was a fool's errand because they would all be destroyed, you know, by the incoming cavalry, and usually any interaction with government was the point of the spear coming at you. A great emphasis, a warrior culture with a great emphasis on individual liberty and personal sovereignty. And they were in high regard in the colonial era because these were border people used to holding down the ground of empires and were very useful from the point of view of people in power for doing that. A large number of Scots-Irish were intentionally brought by some of the early proprietors of coastal Maine to hold down the mid-coast against Native American incursions. That's why Maine has, as those readers of Lobster Coast will know, that that's why Maine has a rather different history and a history of insurrection against the Federalist gentry that shaped our character even to this day. But another place they did it was in Pennsylvania. At a time when this was the frontier and it was a very dangerous place to protect the effete cheese-eating settlements of the Delaware Valley and the coast up and down, they brought in and welcomed huge numbers of Scots-Irish to come and settle. They went straight through Philadelphia and out and settled this area and then poured down the Appalachian mountain range, following the Great Wagon Road, diverting into the Piedmont, onto the Ozarks, and down the Ohio River to settle the lower tiers of many of the Midwestern states, and then spreading out all the way to the hill country of Texas and Oklahoma. And here is a very, very different culture, and you will see that it affects all kinds of things, including political behavior. You see the red state, blue state map all the time. It's rather deceptive because you go down to the red and blue county maps, radio audience, look some of them up, and you will see the general outlines. Here you go on this map of the presidential election. You can see the left coast, which has a different settlement history than the interiors of California and Oregon and Washington. You can see some of the movements in El Norte, and you can especially see that in one color you have the whole greater New England cultural zone I just described. There's a Western Reserve of Ohio and so on. And then you have an almost monochrome in the Deep South and greater Appalachia in a different color. And no, I'm not messing with the colors. Greater New England really is red, and that really is Republican, because I'm not showing you a recent presidential map. This is the 1916 showdown between Woodrow Wilson and Charles Hughes. Trying to understand American political history using a partisan rubric is a fool's errand, because the parties come and go. Where the Federalists and Whigs today, and they also invert their constituencies and regional backgrounds and indeed policy, which is what the Republicans and Democrats have done over the past century, and particularly in the past 40 years, has been a complete inversion of their policies and constituencies, which will give you no surprise that if you move forward and compare the map with 2008, you're seeing essentially the same map. This is Obama versus McCain, only the colors are reversed. There's a couple differences on that map, though. One of the differences is that the Deep South is no longer a monochrome. You're seeing a whole band in another color in here. And over here, you're seeing all of El Norte pop out in a way it didn't. Well, what's the difference between 1916 and 2008? What would account for that? That's because between 1916 and 2008, Hispanic Americans and African Americans were finally able to exercise the franchise. And unfortunately, in the Deep South, where race and political preference are matched. Those are almost all majority African-American counties where the public is able to express their will, and ditto in El Norte, which had a similar racial caste system that suppressed voting by minorities. So the parties come and go, and you need to understand that when the things get contentious, we break almost always on the same fissure lines over and over in our history throughout. So American Nations was history, but the lesson for today, the one that ended up at the end of American Nations, was an explanation for how it is that we're deadlocked. And it explained that at this time in history, we have these shifting coalitions. The only reliable coalitions in the current framework, you know, red, we'll say red is Republican, blue is Democrat these days, the blue bloc in the past few decades, the only reliable members of that bloc are the nations I've marked as Yankeedom, New Netherland, the Dutch settled area around New York City, and the Left Coast, which is the area between the mountains and the sea and the Pacific Coast, between Monterey, California, and Juneau, Alaska, which was settled from the sea by Yankees and simultaneously overland from the wagon trail by people largely from the greater Appalachian sections of the Midwest, and is a hybrid culture, but with very different characteristics than the interior West at the same time. Those three, up against a reliable red coalition, greater Appalachia, deep south, and far west. Well, the problem with that is neither of those coalitions I've just described, when you overlay the Electoral College map and the House of Representatives map and the state map for the Senate, give you control over any kind of lock or supermajority in the federal government to control the levers of federal power in Washington. And we've had long periods where one political formation or another has, not necessarily a party formation. The parties until recently weren't sorted ideologically as neatly as they suddenly are today. But you would have these lasting multi-decade coalitions that would govern in Washington and guide policy. You had the laissez-faire order in the late 19th century. You had the New Deal order in the post-war period in the United States. But not so today. And because of that, both parties are operating without a supermajority and trying to win over residents in the swing nations, the most classic one being the Midlands that don't quite see either a bloc, aren't totally sold on them. So we're in this unstable period I described at the end of American Nations, which is why you go from one election to another. You keep having these pendulum swings. You have an election, oh, you know, the Republicans are vanquished for a generation. And then 2 years later in the midterms, oh, the Democrats are vanquished for a generation, and so on and so forth. It's because we're at an unstable time where there's not that kind of agreement, and it's leading to that kind of polarization that has deadlocked the federal government to the point where we can't even reliably pass not only budgets, but reliably raise the debt ceiling for budgets we already voted to pass. It's a very difficult situation for the world's only superpower to be in, not only for our country, but for the world. So to get past that, I said, in American Nations, one political formation or the other would have to modify their platform that they're offering in such a way to capture a supermajority of these nations. What's happened throughout our history is that one bloc or the other has put forward something that gives you reliably a coalition of regional cultures that isolates one of the other's opponents. Those, you know, the superpowers since the, you know, 1820s on the map, there's always been one coalition built around Yankeedom and another coalition built around the Deep South, and they duke it out, and their coalition partners have shifted around in history, but that's basically the battle, is one or the other isolates the other's formation. But how to do that? How do you pull that off? Well, that's what American character takes on, is trying to do that particular mission. Now, at the outset, if one is trying to figure out how you do that, what a lasting coalition would look like, you have to identify what the key conflict point is in our political conversation. And in the American conversation, that's all about freedom. How do you maximize and build a free republic and create a free society? Now, that's not true of many other places. In other societies, it may be fairness, it may be order, it may be trying to bring basic security, it may be building the greatness of the nation, but here it's always been a conversation about freedom. However, what are you talking about when you're talking about freedom? Are you thinking about it in its individual form or its community form? Because there's a conflict in there. Are you maximizing individual freedom, or are you trying to maximize creation of a free society? You end up with a spectrum, which is important to understand. You don't want to run into extremes in either direction, because if you err too far in one direction or another, not very useful things happen. So at the center of the conversation, ask yourself the question, when individual freedom and the common good come into conflict, on what side should you err? Well, if you err a little bit, you know, into the collectivist side of the spectrum, you enter sort of a communitarian space. And if you move a little bit further on down that road, you end up into social democracy, which, you know, there's a lot of confusion in the American conversation lately as to what these terms mean. But remember, social democracy is a vigorous free market economy harnessed through taxation and other things to support a very extensive institutional environment of government to supposedly further the freedom and success of the society at large. You keep going further down that spectrum, and you end up in actual socialism, which is when you actually start having the state control the means of production as well, ostensibly for the good of society, industry and mines and so forth. And then you enter into sort of an orthodox form where they might even own every single restaurant and banking establishment and kiosk in your country. And you keep on going down that path, and you start running into the problem that as you head down there, you're supposed to enter that nirvana of communism, where the state withers away because we individuals have all become new men and have been engineered to be a better people. But that never happens, right? Because what really happens in the world in practice is that the keepers of the common good end up looking upon dissenting and unorthodox and idiosyncratic behavior as a danger or a threat to the carefully laid plans they have put forward. And you can get to the point where you end up where individuals can create thought crimes and where everyone is supposed to surrender to the superego of the party or the fatherland or whatever the instrument or vessel is that's supposed to be furthering the common good in these extreme scenarios. So you end up with, you know, Orwell, Stalin's Soviet Union, Hitler's Germany. Oh, my gosh, what bad things. We must not go in that direction, right? Except if you go in the other direction of the spectrum, the same thing starts happening. You go a little bit on one side, and you enter into the libertarian era, what we in America call libertarian space, although a better word would probably be liberal, as in classical liberalism of John Locke, or the second word in the phrase neoliberal. But you go a little bit further, if you head down that road further and further and more extremely, the rationale that less taxes, less government, and less regulation axiomatically has to mean more freedom for the individual, as government's ability and willingness to step in as a referee starts disappearing, inequality starts growing enormously. Because the gains asymmetrically accrue not just to the most able, but also to the most rapacious, or simply those born to a vast inheritance. And the space and starts contracting as all the leveling mechanisms of the state start contracting as well. Progressive taxation, quality public schools and universities, healthcare systems, parks and libraries, and so on. You start having a diversion. You start having things go further and further down a path where you start having to have ideologies to explain away the pathologies that are starting to emerge, the growing chasm. Those typically are things like the rich deserve more freedom because they're more virtuous, or ideologies that say the poor deserve less because of moral or possibly genetic shortcomings. We've seen all this through history in our own country and others. And the further you go down that stream, you reach eventually a sort of radical libertarian thought of like Ayn Rand, of objectivism, wherein altruism and public-mindedness are explicitly condemned as being evil. And if you keep going to the logical extreme, you would theoretically end up in anarchy, anarcho-capitalism if you're an optimist, where government vanishes away, where might makes right and merit leads you to the top. But again, you never really get there. Because what happens, nobody's ever gotten there, right? History has shown again and again that instead, a few families maximize their freedom successfully and end up taking it away from everyone else, and you get an oligarchy. Now, this has happened over and over in history. Look at medieval Hungary. You know, the nobles basically constrained the king, the government, and they used that constraint to re-enslave and re-inserf the population of Hungary, the peasant population, and refused to give and donate to maintain the standing army of the Hungarian kingdom, which led them to be completely overrun by the Ottoman invasion and the Hungarian yoke of centuries. Same thing, and you could see the same patterns happen in 20th century Guatemala and El Salvador, where you know the 10 families and the 12 families, caps on 10 and 12, end up controlling all the land, all the business, the army, the courts, and eliminate anybody who gets in their way. Well, until other cartels and forces came and knocked them out of the way. So tyranny as well. What is one to do? Tyranny lying in both directions. So logically, somewhere in there, if going headstrong and down the collectivist path and the common good path, or going headstrong down the individualism, individual freedom path eventually leads you to tyranny. Somewhere in there is a logical balance point where these two essential aspects of freedom are in equilibrium, that sweet spot where you've actually maximized everything. Somewhere in there and have a maximally free society. Of course, that's a little tricky, right? Because conditions are always changing. That's why it's such a tricky proposition to keep tacking and keeping on the ball. Being a liberal democracy is an incredibly challenging thing. And remember, liberal democracy, you're trying to have, the goal is universal individual liberty. And the paradox is, which American Character describes and points out, is that you can't have widespread individual liberty without the civic and social and public infrastructure that supports it. Because lest we forget at our own peril that there's nothing at all natural about liberal democracy. It is not a natural state of affairs. It's an extraordinary human achievement. It's eons in the making and has taken four centuries of cautious and not always successful experimentation to pull off. In the 5,000 years that our species has had complex civilizations, despotism and autocracy have been the norm. Universal human freedom, individual freedom as an idea, wasn't even part of anybody's worldview until a few thinkers started talking about it in the early 1700s. But what about ancient Greece and Rome? We remember those from those same textbooks we had in school, right? Those were liberal democracies, weren't they? Models for America? That's why we built all our civic infrastructure in that, in, you know, neo-Roman and neo-Athenian structures. No, they weren't liberal democracies. They were slave states. They were places where a small group of people, privileged people, had the liberties, the privileges to practice democracy, a special caste of people, and that enslavement and subjugation were considered the natural lot of the many. So they weren't liberal democracies at all. Mass individual freedom requires a government of sufficient strength to ensure that our American competition remains free and fair. It has to avoid monopoly and cheating in the economic sphere. It has to be able to avoid intergenerational monopolies of opportunity and thus liberty in the social sphere. That's why you need the libraries and the healthcare systems and colleges and parks and transports and water supplies and all of those things. And the taxes to support them is to maintain that state where you could have universal individual freedom. There's also that entire aspect of cultivating a republican citizenry upon which this whole idea rests. Like de Tocqueville talked about with the habits of the mind. A citizenry that's informed and responsible and has a reasoned commitment to liberal values in a free and open society. So we need balance. Well, that's easier said than done. So what's the U.S.'s balance point? I mean, it's relatively easy to describe the balance point of a lot of our other peer liberal democracies, places that are unitary nation states or maybe have just two big components, places like Japan or many European states, Germany or France, where there's general consensus on the big issues about where the balance ought to lie. But it's hard for us because of our balkanization, because we're really multiple countries, each with entirely different takes on where the proper balance point lies. And the book, you'd have to look through all the 11 variables through our history to understand what is possible and where the consensus lies. Good news is, American Character does this for you and takes you on that journey. Now, a note, as you explore it, if you pick up the book and read it, pull it out of your library if you don't want to buy it, note that we've been in dangerous realms before. We've been down the bad paths. In the regional level, I mean, the Puritans displayed the dangers of ignoring individual liberty, right? There's a relatively communitarian society in the beginning, strongly collective, where individuals had very little rights, and that gave us things that, like the Salem witch trials or the conditions that inspired Nathaniel Hawthorne to write the Scarlet Letter. The antebellum Deep South shows us how the rapacious, single-minded pursuit of individual liberty can take you astray into a universe where the oligarchy is literally and explicitly defending and will fight a war to defend the freedom and liberty to enslave. Here's Confederate currencies, which contain the key property, enslaved workers actually placed right on the Confederate banknotes during the Civil War. That's how central it was to their ideas. On a federal level, we face the Gilded Age. where you had monopoly, where the concentration of wealth became so large that everybody was starting to become concerned about the control of the Senate and the government actually being captured. And indeed, we had the enormous oscillations in the economy eventually leading to the stock market crash in 1929. So we've faced those things before. Fortunately, as a federation, we've always had a really strong firewall against collectivist tyranny. Because all of our regional cultures, even the more communitarian-minded ones like the Greater New England Yankee cultural space, are still very individualistic compared to many of our peer countries. And because of that, efforts to push in from a communitarian zone, a sort of national liberalism of the New Deal, into social democratic realms have always been pushed back in our history. Some of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's programs, like the National Recovery Act during the height of the Great Depression, tried to tightly manage the economy for the common good, you know, fixing prices and actually controlling industrial a movement of industrial goods. And even at that time of crisis, it was strongly pushed back by voters, revived again to fight successfully World War II, but immediately in the post-war period also pushed back. There are similar parallels with aspects of Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society that within a year and a half after its promulgation were just hammered in the midterm elections of 1964. The federal government attempting to directly go in and promising to be able and have the knowledge to fix poverty and to raise up the citizenry, things that it wasn't actually able to do successfully as a federal deployment. Of course, when I finished this manuscript to this book in the spring of 2015, I was sounding a warning that the shoals of tyranny might lie ahead and that we could strike them if we didn't alter course. And frankly, I was thinking, you know, 6 or 10 years down the road, not within months of the book being published. But our republic's now under threat from within. How did it happen? Well, I know many of you are interested in the recent election from November. This you're looking at here, those of you in the audience, is a county map of the results of the 2016 presidential race by county, with the borders of the regional cultures also noted in there. And this map, for the most part, follows the same pattern one would expect, and the same pattern we've seen in most recent elections, due to 2012, 2008, in the Bush years. Essentially, you have the left coast, El Norte, New Netherland, and Yankeedom, and now Tidewater on one side, and Greater Appalachia, the Deep South, and the Far West on the other. Here's the margin of victory by regional culture, color-shaded. You're seeing essentially the same patternings as to who won. But the overall result masks two developments, which are critical to the result of the election. The Democratic candidate, the more communitarian of the two candidates in this particular election, only won the great swing region of the country, the Midlands. The Midlands were founded by originally by the Quakers. It emphasizes a mosaic of multiple cultures, ethnicities, and religions all living side by side with nobody in particular in charge and nobody's supposed to be, high neighborliness and communitarianism and loyalty to sort of middle class values at a local level, but extreme distrust of top-down government intervention at the same time, which has made it a swing region and a kingmaker for much of our country's history, starts around Philadelphia in the Delaware Valley, and then forms a strip of what we consider the heartland out across the Midwest and pouring out over Iowa and parts of the Great Plains. It's our great swing region. Hillary Clinton only won the Midlands in November by 0.4%, whereas Obama won it by 11 points in 2008 and by 6 in 2012. Essentially, it was a tie, which isn't good enough for a Democratic candidate to overcome the enormous Greater Appalachian sections in key swing states like Ohio and Pennsylvania. She also only won the Greater New England space, Yankeedom. She won it by 9 points, but Obama won it by 19 in 2008 and 16 points in 2012. Indeed, Trump's gains, you know, Donald Trump won the Electoral College fairly narrowly, lost the popular vote by almost 3 million votes. So it was a very tight that he pulled it off. The key places for him that allowed him to do that, when you intersect change in direction for where and how people voted, and you overlay the Electoral College map, the key ones are certain areas of Yankeedom, which really delivered it to him, and the shift in the Midlands. These are areas where scores of white rural counties, right, exactly the places that conventional political analysts tell you will vote Republican. There's scores of them in rural New England, upstate New York, and a certain area of the upper Mississippi Valley. This is the 2012 map with Mitt Romney's election. The 2008 map will look almost exactly the same. This zone, there's a zone of rural white counties that, just like northern New England and upstate of New York, voted for Obama by wide margins in both 2008 and 2012. It's where Wisconsin and Minnesota, Illinois, and the Yankee-settled portion of Iowa all come together on the map. Well, mass defection. You look at this map, and almost all of those counties flipped from Obama twice to Trump, including chunks of Maine and upstate New York. You see the pattern across the map. And that was sufficient to let Trump get narrow victories in Wisconsin and Michigan, and even to win one of Maine's electoral votes. So then the question is, why? Why did that? Why was there that shift, which was critical on the stage, right? You lose your margin in the Midlands, and Pennsylvania and Ohio are probably lost to a Democratic candidate. And then why rural white counties in Yankeedom that voted for Obama twice, voting for Donald Trump this time? What's the shift? You know, I think, you know, that everyone's a racist is probably a poor explanation if they voted for the nation's first African-American president and voted to reelect him by large margins. So what goes on? Well, my analysis is that Trump was different. The menu choice in this election was different than almost all of our elections in human memory right now in the United States, in that there was not as stark a choice between a common good community freedom building agenda and a individual freedom, less taxes, less government, we'll breathe more freedom agenda. Those are two choices in almost all the elections you can possibly remember going back. Except this one was a little different, because Donald Trump alone, among the 17 candidates for the Republican nomination last year, 16 of them were less government, less taxes, less regulation, gives you more freedom. Every single one of them except Trump. He didn't say any of those things on the campaign trail. He said, rather, government will intervene to protect all of you that have been downtrodden by government before. We're going to build a wall. We're going to bring back American manufacturing. We're going to protect Social Security. We'll get rid of Obamacare, gets inferior, and replace it with something terrific. No words on the campaign trail about tax cuts and cutting of programs, quite the opposite. So it was, for a Republican candidate, a remarkably communitarian agenda, shifted way back towards the center on that particular axis from all of his competitors and from competitors in recent election cycles. That's a pretty remarkable shift there, and guess what? It worked. He absolutely crushed the entire Republican establishment. Huge figures, Jeb Bush, inheritor of the Bush dynasty, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, the new upcoming people, Scott Walker, all just steamrolled over by a television celebrity with no background in government. That seems to have been a very powerful message, you know, and extremely effective not only then, but also even in the Democratic primary. I mean, Hillary Clinton, remember, ended up with an unexpectedly robust challenge from an avowed social Democrat. Remember, I just finished saying that there's a sort of firewall, sort of third rail on the collectivist side in American politics, where any time you try to go into social democracy, you get zapped backwards outside of wartime. Except this time, you had a highly competitive race. If you looked at the Democratic county map, Sanders versus Clinton, for those in the room, green or Sanders country, basically Sanders swept all of, in the Democratic primaries, swept all of Yankeedom and the far west and most of the left coast outside of San Francisco itself. And they fought to a head-to-head in Democratic primaries in the Midlands, and Hillary Clinton took the Dixie Nations and New Netherland around New York City and El Norte by convincing margins. But you can see that there was Hillary was running as the inheritor to the Obama legacy, but she got tagged by both her primary and general election opponents, got tied to her husband's neoliberalism, which is highly unpopular in Yankeedom, particularly amongst those key rural shifting counties I described, and I think in the Midlands as well. That particular argument does not have much traction, which is why it's going to be very interesting going forward if indeed the Trump administration in practice is following a more laissez-faire agenda. What will happen to those groups of people, which I've tagged the Trump Democrats? Will they remain loyal or will they feel betrayed? Will be a interesting and very important question for American politics going forward. Of course, the danger in all this is that in addition to that, Trump also is the first candidate to win a nomination and the presidency in living memory who was not running in the liberal democratic tradition. He was running as a European-style authoritarian, a ethno-nationalist. Government protection promised for the good Americans, or the good Hungarians, or the good Poles, or the good Germans, and extra legal and perhaps extra constitutional punishment for the internal traitors, beatings, jailing of opponents, religious criteria for citizenship, racist screening of federal judges. The involvement of the Russian state and the FBI in the electoral process has not been reassuring in this respect. So the Republic is now under siege, a more serious internal threat since the Gilded Age and possibly the Civil War. And if we survive it, indeed if the world survives it, we're going to need to rebuild and do so on more solid foundations. Now, the book identifies and talks about what the sweet spot is. So I'm going to give you a rough sketch and encourage you to dive into it. This is not what Colin Woodard wants, but what, based on an evaluation of the historical evidence, what would actually work and what is actually possible within the American constraints to give a political formation, a regional and thus a political supermajority, again, operating within the liberal democratic goals and framework. Now, I would say that what bonds us together, what the big, you know, ultimately the American idea, the American way broadly shared, is the pursuit of happiness. This is a particularly American thing, too, right? It's not other countries. The pursuit of happiness via free and fair competition between individuals and their ideas and their institutions. Get out there, you know, do your best, see if you can hit your potential. May the best person win, and a belief that in aggregate, this is going to create a dynamic and adaptable and healthy and indeed free society. And indeed, it has done those things. We've done remarkable things through that American way. But there's an important qualification in all that. Americans want this competition to be free and fair, that people don't get to cheat and get away with it, either through monopolistic or parasitic behavior, and that there's a government force out there strong enough to regulate and make sure that that doesn't happen. And Americans get furious about these things across the political spectrum. Recall that the Tea Party movement, it really took off, if you look back through the history, which I did while writing the book, it's not when CNBC reporter started spouting off about tea parties at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, but rather when the AIG division guys, the guys from the reinsurance company that had just almost brought down the world economy and were being bailed out, when it was announced that the very unit that had almost destroyed everything, that taxpayers were going to bail out, that all those people were going to get their fat bonuses that they'd been promised. Things went absolutely berserk on that moment. Remember, they were having to post guards at the little, you know, base in Connecticut where they were, in Stamford or somewhere. People weren't reporting to work. People were resigning because they were afraid for their life. You had Barney Frank, who sat on the banking committee, writes in his memoirs that it was a certain moment that the red-hot anger was so large he wasn't sure whether or not they would be capable of governing. That was a big, big moment. On the other side, political figures in the U.S., from Ronald Reagan all the way through to Paul LePage, have made taking on alleged welfare cheats the central idea of their campaigns with great success. In both cases, the anger is based on the idea that taxpayers, that ordinary people, are being cheated by the unscrupulous, either at the very top or on the bottom. And it makes people very upset, and they're highly motivated on it. This is a deep, deep concern that is universally shared out there. It's government that's supposed to protect our freedom from external enemies, to ensure that economic competition is fairly played. And it's not a government that offers a hand up instead of a handout. It's a government supposed to have your back as you go out there in that great American competitive struggle. It also means things on the social front, too, though, because you have to rechannel some wealth into leveling institutions that ensure that all power and resources don't accrue unfairly and in a non-merit-based fashion to certain families as a matter of birth, right? Take your playing field. If you just started and assume that everybody is at an even start, and let's just say they are, fast forward four or five generations, and the winning families with no regulation or of anything are going to accrue their power, and it's going to start restricting the ability of anybody else to move forward. That's not the free and fair environment that we're talking about. It's an aristocracy, which is why you have to end up investing some of it back into the framework that allows everyone to be able to go out there and fight that free and fair struggle and get to the chance to work with their own potential and achieve it, regardless of whether they were born in good circumstances or bad. That means the early childhood education and health insurance and public schools and universities and all bridges and Pell Grants and all those other things we talk about. And it does involve higher taxes, obviously. It's also on the wealthy who've benefited the most. But this, again, is not unusual in the American history and experience. Back in the 1950s, golden age people talk about of grand prosperity widely shared, the highest tax bracket in 1952 under Dwight Eisenhower was 92%. Today it's 39.6%. I'm not saying that you need to go to 92%, but I'm saying there's kind of some leeway somewhere in there as far as these things work. And it has a long and bipartisan tradition if you go back and look through our history. Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Hoover, Obama, Eisenhower, intellectuals today from Francis Fukuyama to Michael Gerson. And indeed, the preamble of our own Constitution, that preface laying out the purpose of the document, to promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our prosperity, ensuring the common good and individual liberty intergenerationally. There's nothing, I would argue, that's more American than that. I'm going to stop there and open it to questions.
Aren't we becoming more homogenized due to our education system, our media, et cetera? And is that good or bad?
An excellent question. You would think that the regional cultures would be disappearing. Add to that list mass communication, mass retailing. Everybody's getting their news from the same sources. You go out to the hinterland of every town and city, and they all tend to look the same with the same signs and such. How could it be that these regional cultures exist? Sure, I buy that in 1910 maybe this existed, but surely it's all gone now. We're moving around. People travel from one place to another. Except you have to confront that by every possible measurable metric, the differences between them are getting worse. The political polarization is larger. You poll on any kind of system of values or ideas on policy, and you're seeing a consistent divergence as each of them is starting to compound and concentrate even more so. Well, how could that be? Well, there's a couple parts to that answer. One answer is that immigration has never been uniform across the landscape. For instance, in the great waves of 19th century immigration after the Civil War and running through the Immigration Act of 1922, I guess it was, almost all of the immigrants went to New Netherland and the Midlands, which makes sense because these are places that prized multi-ethnic, multi-religious societies and nobody in particular in charge. That made it awfully easy to show up as an immigrant and feel like you were part of the game. And to Yankeedom, which was none of those things. Yankeedom's the melting pot. You can come here, but you must assimilate and become like us. Some of you may have noticed this here and there in corners of Maine. However, it had the industrial jobs to pull people in to do that. And it also had certain synergies in pull with, like, if you go to the Scandinavian migration zone, up in Minnesota and the upper Midwest tiers, you had a pull of a similar religious and cultural framework between the Calvinist post-Puritan traditions of greater New England and the Lutheran state-sponsored church, frugality, the individual must stand down for the good of the cycled community, and so on and so forth, that meant that people often were self-sorting. And almost no immigrants from that wave went to Appalachia, the Deep South, or Tidewater. Because if you're fleeing an oppressive feudal system at home with no opportunities to own your own land and make your way in life, you're probably not going to go to somewhere that is repeating that in the New World, and indeed none of them do. And that's carried out. I show a census map that shows the mapping, essentially, of where people went, and it's absolutely shocking how the contrast. So that reinforced some of those tendencies. But secondly, and more to your point today, some researchers have asked the question, why is it, for instance, the book The Big Sort, which asked, why is it that the number of counties that are swing counties you know, where the margin of result, still competitive, has been going down and down with each decade dramatically. 20% of the 3,100 counties in the country were always a lock for one party, the other always winning by more than 20 points in 1972, and now it's like 60 or 80% of them. Why is that? And they tracked all kinds of data on people moving around as people migrated across the country. And here's what they discovered, which has since been backed up by other social science researchers. Statistically speaking, as people move around, decide to move somewhere else, when people move, to the extent they can, they are choosing to move somewhere where they feel they belong and are around like-minded people. They are self-sorting to whatever extent they can. And it turns out that the characteristics, political, cultural, values, or otherwise, when people poll and look at these things, the characteristics of those who choose to move resemble more closely their destination, the people in their destination, than the people in the place they left. Because in every single one of the counties on the American nation's map, you, of course, have people who have the entire range of political opinion in every county, right? The bluest of blue and the reddest of red counties, still you have, you know, 35% of the electorate voting for the wrong side, right? There's a whole wealth of diversity under that. It's just what is the dominant tone of the culture you're in. And if you're frustrated, sometimes you feel like, I just love where I live. I feel like this is where I belong. People share my values. Other people may say, why don't people see these unexamined assumptions they have are completely wrong? It drives me completely crazy. If my job ever moved, I would move somewhere where people, you know, that's what goes on to some extent. And it's enough that we are self-sorting and increasing the differences between the regional cultures as people move with their feet to some extent. So those are two of the answers to that question to try to understand why the data is showing us that the nations aren't dying, they're getting more vigorously themselves.
Since you brought him up, we've got several questions relating to Trump. And what I will do is I will ask all of them, and you can see how you want to work into them. If Trump is a European-style autocrat, who do you think he will make alliances with? Putin, the nationalists, who? What do you see as the greatest threat of a Trump presidency? Sorry to get too political, but do you see the election of Trump as a danger to that balance point you were talking about between individualism and communitarianism?
Well, I think, you know, we know from Donald Trump himself via Twitter the answers to most of those questions, and the answer is that he wants to align with Putin, that NATO is an alliance that no longer should be respected, that the EU is a failed institution, and that he's likes, you know, some of the nationalist leaders within Britain, like Nigel Farage, before he's going to meet Theresa May, even. So we know where he's standing on that. You know, things are moving very fast, but on this particular day of January 16th, we know from the interviews in Europe and the reaction in Europe to his recent interviews with Bild and the Times that the standing reaction is that suddenly Europe stands alone, that they're between two potentially authoritarian governments to the east and across the Atlantic to the west, and that Merkel is there by herself. Merkel also targeted for criticism by Trump in the interview. So in European capitals on this particular day, everybody is enormously alarmed. Now, Trump hasn't even taken office. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but all indications in that way are extremely worrying, as all of you know on this particular day. Maybe he'll be mercurial and he'll shift back, but and his own cabinet appointees to some of his positions have contradicted him in regards to NATO and other things, so we'll see how that plays out in the end. But it's extremely worrying. And the yes, of course, somebody who's running as a European-style ethno-nationalist and against the liberal democratic traditions of the country is an extreme threat to the republic and the future of our democracy. The Constitution is just a piece of paper. If nobody enforces it, it means nothing. And if anything, you know, being based in Eastern Europe and the Balkans at the end of communism before it collapsed as an exchange student and staying on as a foreign correspondent through what happened next and watching the rise of fascist and genocidal governments as well as extreme militaristic ones and the rise of ethno-nationalists, now even in Hungary, in places like Romania and certainly in Bosnia-Herzegovina and watching what happens, I see dangerous parallels in rhetoric and otherwise. We cannot be complacent about any of this. You know, we're not, American exceptionalism only carries you so far. Now, I was based in, you know, nobody in Sarajevo thought that could possibly, what happened to Sarajevo would happen. You know, they were a democratic, multi-ethnic city and artists and culture, and they never dreamed that they'd suddenly be surrounded one morning and besieged, and that the rest of the West would actually sit there and do nothing while the siege took place for years and years on their doorstep. So, yes, perhaps I take a pessimistic view of these things, but these are dangerous times and dangerous waters.
Republicans, as you pointed out, seem to be at odds with Trump.
Yeah, well, again, we're going to have to see how that plays out. The congressional Republicans are at odds with Trump's campaign rhetoric, right? What we don't know is how Trump is actually going to govern, how he's going to step forward on the big issue. The congressional Republicans are moving forward with a very much the laissez-faire version of government and, you know, making the cutting back on services and taxes and everything will be better. Trump did not campaign as that. Many of his appointees suggest he'll do that, so that's the big question. And what does that mean for that critical Trump-Democrat bloc I described that delivered several states narrowly for Trump's coalition? How will they react to that? Is that going to end up mattering? We'll find out. But again, you know, we don't know exactly. Still hasn't even been inaugurated into office. We don't know exactly how he's going to govern and how all this plays out, but those are all the big questions out there.
Unfortunately, we've run way over, but I've got one more question that I want to do, and I think you've sort of answered parts of it, but you'll see what it's getting at. Going from your book, American Nations, which I think you wrote about 10 years ago, to American Character, what most surprised you, disappointed and or encouraged you? What changed? What opinions changed in terms of the United States, in terms of our future over those 10 years?
Well, yeah. So American Nations came out in 2011. So I was doing the heavy lifting on it in sort of 2010-ish, I guess. And the new book, I was doing the heavy lifting on it in 2015, first half or so, before the election got underway. So, I mean, the big shockwave to American politics came after I finished the manuscript, you know, it's starting into this election cycle. So the differences between 2011 and 2015 in terms of when I was actually writing the books weren't that large. What was clarifying is talking to people for 4 years or so about American Nations, which has been, you know, received pretty widely and generally pretty supportively, but the questions that people would have coming out of it is, how do we get around the polarization, right? So the question was still polarization. Our country is deadlocked. It can't continue that way. It's a threat to the country and the world. And so this book is answering, well, here's how you get around it. Only the sort of threat to the country and the world is now upon us. The West is now in crisis, and so these questions are now almost a repair manual instead of a set of prophylactic instructions going forward. But that's something that happened after I finished the manuscript, not before.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. If you missed all or part of today's Speaking in Maine, the program is available on our website, mainepublic.org, where Speaking in Maine is also available for streaming and as a podcast. Charles Beck is the executive producer for Speaking in Maine on Maine Public. I'm Jonathan Woodward.